Ian and I have known each other for a number of years, and you'll know that I also have a connection, not such a close connection, with the Prince of Wales, having written a book about him called Radical Prince, The Practical Vision of the Prince of Wales. It came out over 10 years ago now and was translated into a couple of other, three other languages. And my first contact, actually, with him was way back in 1991, when I was asked, I think it was must have been by Kathleen, to be part of a group to contribute towards the birthday speech on Shakespeare at Stratford, which HRH was putting together. And Keith Critchlow was there, and so was Sir Eric Anderson, who did a selection of the Prince's favourite pieces of Shakespeare. And so that was a very interesting process, just that all that particular speech coming together. And then I didn't have much contact for some time. Anyway, enough of that. Little story I was going to tell you by way of introducing Ian is that I was on my way back, must have been in July last year, from East Lothian to Fife, and it was the proms. And who should be introducing the proms that other than Ian, and who made us very welcome to the Albert Hall, as is his wont. And we then had a piece, but it was after the interval, and he was introducing Beethoven's Seventh. And you probably remember this. Well, I mean, you maybe don't, because I mean, there's so many different proms that you introduce. But the point of telling you this story is that I said to my George is 16, and he never listens to any classical music. And I said to George, I'm afraid you're going to have to listen to this, because this is one of the greatest symphonies ever written. One of my duties as a parent is to introduce you to this guy. And I think he quite liked it, you know. And we just got home about a couple of minutes before the end, and I made him sit in the car to listen to the end, because the end, as many of you will know, the end of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony is so exciting and exhilarating, and of course the applause comes in right afterwards. It was a really terrific experience. Anyway, Ian gives us a great deal of pleasure by introducing us, and he also said one thing, which he may remember, which I was really struck by, and that's that when this symphony was first performed, the audience was so carried away by the slow movement, isn't that right, that they asked to hear it again. You know, before the third movement came on, and the second movement of Beethoven's Seventh is one of the most sublime pieces of music ever written. Anyway, enough of these little anecdotes. Ian is going to speak to the Prince's principles and the role, the harmony and role that he obviously played in bringing all the book together. And I think the book now really stands as a testament to what I was originally going to say, which I've just remembered, which is the idea of the Prince as a potential as a philosopher king. And he's somebody who is a Christian Platonist, in my view. And so, coming back to what Satish was saying this morning, the importance of the true, beautiful, and the good. Ian, thank you very much for coming.
Well, hello again. It's very nice to be here and to talk actually to quite a few people I already know, and also to many more people who I've met in the past day who I feel I do now know. It's lovely and rather a privilege for me to be talking to a group that includes Satish, who I've known for many years. I first came across Satish when he gave a similarly stunning talk, and I went and bought the book No Destination and went off to the Gambia where I read this book and was so moved. I actually don't remember much of my visit to the Gambia because I was so immersed in this book. It changed my life. And by then I'd been living in London for a couple of years, and when I first moved to London I took a little flat in Mornington Terrace. This was my first experience of London coming from the north. And only and it was a rather special place because the landlord he called himself a Zen Christian, and he taught me to meditate in St. James's in Piccadilly. He was a remarkable man, and the world's worst driver. He didn't seem to be incapable of driving a car without one wheel being on the pavement. It was the most terrifying thing, him driving down to St. James's. And when I read No Destination, I discovered that Satish had, when he first arrived in London, taken the same flat. And more alarmingly, had been taught to drive by this man. So I have, in my time since then, spent time walking with Satish, but I have never been in a car when he's driven it, and I recommend you don't. And I'm very glad to hear he's still walking. Anyway. Well, I feel a little bit nervous talking to this incredible assembly, and so what I've done is I've brought a longer computerized slideshow, which I hope will distract you from the fact that I'm winging it here, but I'll do my best, because in a sense what I am is a scribe. I'm a wordsmith. I'm a broadcaster. I play with words all of the time, and I suppose, if I'm really honest, what I've helped the Prince of Wales do is articulate the detail of the ideas that he already had. He is one of the busiest people I've ever met, and as a consequence can't spend a lot of time sitting down and writing, and so I think I take a bit of the pressure off there as well. So what I've got here is an attempt to try and explain some of the principles that the Prince sort of speaks for, and then maybe in the second half of the talk just touch on some of the practical applications of this philosophy. I think I said last night that in my experience, the Prince isn't so much a man of ideas as a man of action. He wants to see things happen all of the time. And if any of you have had experience of that, then you'll know what I mean. He gets very frustrated indeed by the lack of action. And I suppose we're all kind of familiar with the ideas that he's been concerned with over the past 30 years or so. He's well known for talking about the plight of the rainforests and how we've decimated those. He's extremely well known for his views on agriculture and the way in which we treat animals and indeed treat the soil. He's perhaps even more famous around the world for his views on architecture and how we build the environments that we live in. And he's also well known and has been very outspoken about the way in which we treat ourselves with healthcare. And he's also been very passionate about this, sacred architecture, the architecture of the temples and cathedrals around the world. Now, when you look at that collection of postcards, as it were, they can seem rather disparate. And this was one of the problems that the Prince got very frustrated about, really, that people thought that he was talking about agriculture in the morning and, you know, talking about architecture in the afternoon. And people couldn't get the connections between all of these different apparently disconnected issues. In his view, they're all absolutely connected, and they're all absolutely rooted in the same sets of principles. And that was really why he wanted, in the end, to try and put it all down in a book that explained how all these things linked together, and to try and maybe encourage people to think in a different kind of way. So that's where the book came from, really. There was actually a film as well made by American television. And I worked very closely with the Prince of Wales and also with Tony Juniper, the environmentalist, to produce this book, which is called Harmony. And I do remember, actually, when we were talking about a title for this book, the Prince was extremely convinced from the very start that we should call it Harmony. I have to say the publishers, a big American conglomerate, weren't very happy about it. They just couldn't understand why he would want to write a book called Harmony, this obscure term. Just to explain, just in case you don't know, I'm sure you do though, I think it's been mentioned already once, the word comes from the Greek word harmonia, which essentially means to join things up. So if the Greeks talked about a building being harmonic, it was well made up, it was joined up, it didn't fall down. And the reason the prince wanted to call it harmony was because, in his view, nature is a joined up system. Nature is harmonic. It is an interconnected, interrelated, interdependent system. And his contention is that we have, in many respects, forgotten that and forgotten our place within that system. I just want to begin by pulling out one quotation from the book, which I think is very important. It comes from Lady Eve Balfour, whom some of you probably know. She founded the Soil Association back in the 1940s. This is her writing towards the end of her life about what they were doing, really, when she reflected on it. Instead of this obsession with disease and its causes, she realized that what they were doing in the Soil Association was looking at the causes of health. And this inevitably led to her realizing that nature is a joined-up system, that all life is one. So I want you just to hold that in your minds, and we'll come back to it at the end. What I thought I could do here is, rather than just stand here and bore on at you, I'd get the Prince of Wales to do a bit of talking as well. So a few years ago, I went up to Burke Hall on the Balmoral Estate. Unbeknownst to the press office at Clarence House, we were in league together, and I took my camera and I did a long, an hour and a half interview with the Prince. And I was rather pleased with this interview because he just relaxed and just talked from the heart about certain things. And I was just digging through some of the clips that I've got from this interview, and I thought I'd just show you one of them, because on reflection and having listened to things that have been said already today, I think he nails it in this particular clip. He nails what he wants to get across. And I think he kind of nails what you've all been talking about here. This clip is preceded by just a little extract from the film that we made called called Harmony.
Representatives from nearly 200 nations will gather in Copenhagen to seek an agreement on a strategy world leaders met in 1990.
We must take more action to reduce the gases, and that's the message.
To seek an agreement on a strategy to fight climate change, can a balance be found?
With issues of such magnitude, I can only appeal to you to listen to the cries of those who are already suffering.
We're beginning to see, I think, the results of this huge experiment, which has probably gone on for the last 250 years since the Enlightenment, which was, I mean, in many ways splendid, but it went too far, it seems to me. So we'd reached a crisis of perception, because the traditional outlook on life saw everything in a unified sense. We have managed, I think, in the last 250 years or more, to fragment everything in existence. We just look at the different parts. We've taken it all to pieces. We've examined, dissected very cleverly, very brilliantly. And in that sense, it's helped us do remarkable things. It's helped us to create every kind of useful and valuable achievement. It's made a huge difference in people's lives. But at the same time, we've lost that essential understanding of the unity of things, because we only see one part of everything. And I think because we've been experimenting with nature and pushing nature so far, in fact, you know, chucking her out the window and saying, you know, we just exploit every aspect of nature for our own purposes, without thinking that at the same time you have to give as much back as you take, we've lost that essential, I think, sense of the sacred, which was always the aspect, I think, which ran through, you could call it, the traditional view of the world and our place in it. But if we just see the world as nothing but a series of material parts to be exploited and used to our own convenience, without understanding that there's another aspect to this, as there is with ourselves. We're not just, you know, physical objects. We're not just mechanical objects. And nature is not just a mechanical process. But if you're taught that that's the case, you end up in a position where you go on testing the whole system, nature, the world, to destruction.
I think it's quite an interesting quote, that, because one of the criticisms of the prince has always been given is that he's anti-science. And I've not found him to be anti-science. And I think he sort of said there, you know, it is marvellous what we have achieved. But you know, we've perhaps gone a bit too far in certain directions. And it fell to me to then attempt to explain what he meant by this in words of two or three syllables, simple ways, not in highfalutin language. Prince William still thought that there were far too many long words in the book, but I did try to keep them to a minimum. And I sort of racked my brains as to how I could possibly get an entry into this. And then I went up to Corder Castle at the invitation of David and Peter on one occasion to a symposium there. And I met a marvellous man called Jörg Schauberger, who we went for a walk in the forest around Corder, just outside Inverness. And he told me about his grandfather, Victor Schauberger. I'm not sure if you've heard about Victor Schauberger, but he was very interested. He was a forester in Austria, and he became very interested in, to begin with, how fish swim in the streams. So here's a fish. Let's start with that. Because Victor Schauberger went walking in the forests in Austria in the 1920s, I think, and one day watched the trout in the stream holding their position when the stream was a fast-flowing stream. And he became quite fascinated by how the fish could hold their position like that. And moreover, he realized that just further downstream there was a little waterfall, and somehow these fish had got up that waterfall. So he started to watch how these fish behave. And I've never seen it happen myself, but he assured me that this is the case. What these trout did was they'd create a kind of whirlpool. They'd start spinning in a circle at the bottom of this little waterfall. And then they'd suddenly disappear. And then moments later, the fish would just fly up the waterfall. And he was intrigued by why this was happening. And his research resulted in the fact that on the back of every scale of every fish, there are little ridges. And as the water flows over the ridges, it causes little whirlpools to spin off the back of the fish. And if you know anything about whirlpools, it can only really do that if there are things going in both directions. And in fact, Jörg demonstrated this rather beautifully with a couple of bottles of water, well, one bottle of water, and then on top of that, he attached a second empty bottle. And when he turned the bottle upside down, the water, of course, stayed in what was now the top bottle, unless you created a whirlpool, in which case the water, like in a bath, would fall to the bottom of the thing, because the air couldn't get out otherwise. So the point of this is that there are two forces travelling here. And what this means from the point of view of the fish is that actually, as Victor Schauberger put it rather elegantly, I think, the fish doesn't swim in the river swims the fish. This is how nature works. It works according to these wonderful principles and spirals and circles. And so if, for example, you drop a little stream of water on a metal sheet, it doesn't go straight for very long. It starts to meander quite naturally and very quickly. And, of course, this is how rivers operate. This is such a ditch on the side of a field, obviously cut by a farmer in a straight line probably about 100 years ago. But as you can see, what nature has done is it's cut a much different path. And that's because of the way in which water travels. It's the way in which the blood in your veins travels. If it flowed in one great lump around your body, your fingers would blow off because of the friction. And indeed, would all get clogged up as well. So when you're looking at a river, you may think you're looking at a great big lump of water running downstream. But actually what you're looking at is millions of these little whirlpools. And if you were to X-ray the water, then that would be what you would be seeing happening. And as a consequence of this, this research, all sorts of interesting things come out of it. For example, there was some research quite recently, and I put it into the book, I think, of a German university who had measured the difference in distance between the mean journey that water would take from the source to the mouth of a river and the actual distance. In other words, the difference between the meandering river and the straight line from source to mouth. So imagine a dollar sign. What do you suppose, roughly speaking, the difference is between those two distances? I heard a word down here somewhere. Someone said pi. Yes, pi. I find that rather interesting. And as these German researchers discovered, if you straighten the river, you break the circle. You get a dirty river. Isn't that interesting? And so rivers flow in both directions, and it depends upon these spirals. So I started to think about spirals, and besides which the Prince of Wales wanted very much to talk about sacred geometry and what this geometry really was all about. So let me just quickly go through this geometry for you. I'm sure a lot of this is extremely familiar to you, but I think it's important just to stress how, certainly from my point of view, how important it is to the Prince of Wales, to the extent that he's now running engineering apprenticeship schemes up in Scotland to try and get engineers again, because there's a big shortage in Scotland of engineers, and there will be in about 15 years. And he's insisted upon these engineers learning sacred geometry. And a lot of people were very cynical of this idea until the feedback forms started to come in, and all of these young kids were reporting that they were absolutely fascinated by it. So, as I say, you might know all of this stuff. If you've read the Da Vinci Code, this is it. Here's a piece of nature, a typical shell. As I'm discovering with my children, they get bigger and they want bigger bedrooms. So here's how this mollusk slowly but surely builds its shell with bigger and bigger chambers. And what, of course, is interesting is if you strip away this the physical side of things and you analyse the structure of something like a shell, then you find that there are certain geometric patterns that lie behind the shell. And they all tend to depend upon a very simple set of numbers, which I'm sure some of you will recognise as the so-called Fibonacci sequence. It's a numerical description of the way in which things grow. It's very simple. So 1 plus 1 equals 2, 1 plus 2 equals 3, 3 plus 2 equals 5, 5 plus 3 equals 8, and so on and so forth. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, and so it goes on. And this is a patterning that you find a lot in the natural world. So many plants grow according to the Fibonacci sequence. From one stem you get two, from two to three to five to eight, and so on and so forth. We seem to have a bee theme running today, so I thought I'd just talk a bit about bees as well. This is a drone bee. Drone bees are the result of an unfertilized egg. So if you look at the ancestry of a drone bee on the mother's side, then you get this fascinating revelation that it starts off with one parent, two, three, five, and so on and so forth. So bees correspond to the Fibonacci sequence, and you find this all over the natural world. And of course, we resonate with it too. So if you talk about music, and we were doing that a little earlier on, here's a typical octave. if you talk about the chromatic scale, so all of the white notes and the black notes, then you've got 13 keys there, with two, three, and you've got the third and the fifth and so on, and the octave obviously is eight as well. And as I say, you find it in lots of different surprising ways. And if you don't know about the Fibonacci sequence, you can waste a whole afternoon discovering about it on YouTube. What the ancients discovered was that if you divide each of these numbers by the one previous to it, you get, roughly speaking, the same answer. So 55 divided by 34 or 34 by 21 or right down to 5 divided by 3, it doesn't really work beyond there, comes to what looks on the face of it to be a little bit of a boring number. But to the ancient Greeks, this was the golden ratio, 1.618. And you find that all over the the natural world, and indeed all the things that they did as well. So what I'm really getting at here, and what I tried to explain in the book, was that that nature conforms to a grammar of what might be called harmony. And a lot of very familiar shapes that we see are to be found in this grammar of harmony. So the five-pointed star here, what you're looking at here is a visual representation of the golden mean. So if that measurement there is 1, then that would be 1.618. And as we well know, that pattern is to be found all over the place. When I was stuck in traffic on the M25, I was next to a Land Rover that had that on its wheel hubs, the five-pointed star. And it keeps on repeating. It's an infinite sort of process. It doesn't resolve. This is a lovely piece of film given to me by John Martineau, who's a wonderful character, a student of the Prince's School of Traditional Arts. If you watch the purple line there, what you're looking at is Venus, which, if you put Earth in the middle of the picture, as we're doing there, and watch Venus from Earth, then you notice that Venus draws this rather elegant pattern. It takes 8 years for it to draw this elegant pattern. Venus is one of the most accurate timepieces in the planetary system. So today you'll find Venus, the morning or evening star, in one position, and 8 years to the day it will be back in that same position. Or 13 Venusian years. 8 versus 13. It's rather interesting, familiar numbers there. And what the ancients did was they managed to map these patterns, and I think this is Kepler's drawing of the movement of Venus over that eight-year period. And it is rather coincidental, perhaps. I'm not suggesting this is actual truth, but if you draw lines to join up the petals of that five-pointed rose pattern, then you get a rather familiar shape. And this is just one of many, many different examples. And if you don't know the work of Keith Critchlow, from whom I got a lot of this material for the book, then it's worth having a look at some of this stuff. Because, and indeed John Martineau, who has his own publishing company now, it blows your mind, some of this geometry. Keith Critchlow published a book some time ago called The Geometry of Flowers. And he demonstrated, and this is just one photograph from the book, how this patterning seems to be there in so many flowers that you might have in your garden. This is a simple daisy. And of course it was there in classical architecture. The whole of the Greek architecture is based upon the golden ratio. So you find this patterning all over the place. And this patterning existed right up to more modern times. So in Renaissance Italy, here's a violin by Stradivarius. It is just interesting, I find, that the proportions of the violin conform beautifully with the golden ratio and the five-pointed star. So this patterning is, we resonate with it. And I work in broadcasting. I take a lot of photographs. And it's interesting, once you start to see this patterning, you see it being used effectively all the time. If you take a photograph of somebody and you position them in the screen according to the golden ratio, for some reason it makes a better picture. And if you watch any television documentary, just notice where they've placed the speaker when they're interviewing somebody. They're never usually central. They're usually not thirds, but they're usually in the golden mean. It's just more pleasing for some reason. And It is perhaps just coincidental, I don't know, but this is a photograph of our DNA molecule. You're looking at it from the top here, not the familiar spiral. But it is interesting, is it not, that you can quite easily, and I did a rather bad drawing here, but you can draw the five-pointed star onto the DNA. So these proportions, I would suggest, are within us as well. And if they're within us, I think the point I'd make is that, therefore we resonate with them, we respond to them. I am the chairman of the Temenos Academy, and we very recently had a talk by Claire van Kampen, who's the wife of Mark Rylance, thank you, yes, I was thinking of the character he's just played in Wolf Hall. And Claire is a remarkable scholar, I think. She was the first female musical director at the RSC. She was the first female director, musical director at the National Theatre, where she met Mark. And together they launched the Globe Theatre. And she's an incredibly erudite scholar of Elizabethan music and that world. And she told the meeting when she gave this talk, and I just share this with you because I think this is mind-blowing. She didn't do it, but somebody did an analysis of The Tempest. And they added up all of the words in The Tempest, and they divided it by the golden mean. And where it falls is here. A speech by Caliban. All infections that the sun sucks up from bogs, fens, flats on Prosper fall and make him by inchmeal a disease. This is the moment in The Tempest where Caliban first announces he's plotting against Prospero. And as Claire pointed out, many a director and many an actor have always considered this moment in the play to be somehow pivotal. The mood changes. And it does so according to the golden mean. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that Shakespeare added up the number of words he'd written and thought, I know, I'll just put a scene in here and then it'll all conform harmonically. I think it's more to do with the fact that it's just in us. And I know from the point of view of being a writer of sorts, you get to a point where you think, just got to change the mood here. You know, musicians talk about this as well. I don't know. It would be interesting to do all sorts of analysis of maybe Bach's music to discover the same sort of thing. So this patterning is important, I think. And what the prince wanted to demonstrate was what happens when you forget this sort of patterning. And this is what happens. This is a car park in Gateshead. Or it was, actually. They knocked it down a few years ago. Thank the Lord. It sat there for about 40 years. It's a very famous car park because Michael Caine threw someone off it in a film called Get Carter. And that's one of the reasons why it survived so long, because lots of people didn't want to knock it down because it was a Hollywood icon. Now, I don't know about you, and forgive me if I offend your sensibilities here. Personally, I find that very ugly. It doesn't please me. It alienates me. I'm very glad I didn't live anywhere near it. Unfortunately, I have to work in the Barbican quite a lot, and I get the same feeling there. I have a particular hatred of the National Theatre, which just appalls me. Same brutalist architecture, which doesn't contain the same kind of patterning that I've been showing you. Much more to do with another kind of approach. Interestingly as well, for an age that was so scientific and so engineering-based, they made a terrible error with this car park, I gather. They didn't factor in the weight of the cars that would park in it. So for 40 years, it wasn't even a car park. So there we are. Let's get rid of that. The interesting thing is that when you forget this and you start to work in a different kind of way, you do end up with something else. And I tried to understand where the roots of this attitude lay. And obviously, the prince wanted to talk about modernism, which is a very controversial issue. People have all sorts of different ideas about modernism. A lot of them think it's to do just with architecture, which of course it isn't. I decided to trace it back to this statement here, which came from Marinetti and the Futurist's Manifesto. The gates of life must be broken down to test the bolts and the padlocks. And he identified that there was a new form of beauty in the world, which was the beauty of the machine. A roaring motor car which seems to run on machine gun fire is far more beautiful than a classical sculpture. That was 1916. If you move forward to a few years later, a man who made many a motor car, Henry Ford, he said this: we don't want tradition anymore. What we want to do is live in the present, and the only history that's worth anything is the history we make today. I'm not suggesting at all that Henry Ford was some heinous criminal. What I'm trying to suggest here is I think there was this interesting, if rather alarming, shift in the centre of gravity of thought towards this more progressive, linear, machine-based attitude. There were people at the time who were rather concerned about this. We've had his name mentioned already once today, Rabindranath Tagore. Here he is writing in 1916, talking about this aggressive force that he was aware of. It's smothering all time and space. All that is human is being broken into fragments. And it's this fragmenting and breaking away from this idea as nature being our guide, which was concerning him. And the consequence of that kind of thinking, I think, is what we see all around us now. This is a listed building in West London. Actually, it's a very clever building. I'm also told the view from it is beautiful. I don't particularly like the view of it, but there we are. But this was designed by a very clever modernist architect. But the dumbed down version is the version that we're seeing now, being thrown up all over the developing world as well. These are new tower blocks in China, which have just been built. What the prince wanted to try and demonstrate was what was lost in all of that, really. And in order to do that, he had to get a bit philosophical. So forgive me if I do the same now, but I'll try and get through it as quickly as possible. If you go back 2,000 years and come across a man called Marcus Aurelius, who was one of the Stoics. I think he was a Roman emperor, actually, as well, I seem to remember. here he is talking about reality. Oh, I see. Well, I can't. I've lost it. But the important key thing here is there is one orderly, graceful disposition of the whole. He was talking about wholeness 2,000 years ago. If you go back 400 years to the time of Plato, but go east, you find someone called Lao Tzu, who I think is talking rather like a particle physicist here. The world and its particles are not separate, isolated things, but one small particle contains the nature of the world, just as the world contains the nature of each small particle. The nature of each is the same. Thus, single events contain the life experience of the whole. So this is a form of thought, traditional thinking, which spans all of these different cultures. If you move into the time of Christianity, right at the very start of things. For me, one of the most beautiful Gospels is a tiny fragment by Mary Magdalene, the Gospel according to Mary Magdalene. It's a beautiful thing to read. I don't know if she did write it, but it's an extremely interesting document. But there she is talking about elements of nature, all interwoven and united with each other. 2,000 years ago, they were observing this. And that was the attitude in Christianity that went right through until the time of Thomas Aquinas in Paris in the 13th century, where he was talking about the order of the universe is the ultimate and noblest perfection in things, with each part articulating the whole in some unique fashion. The perfection is in the whole. It is the fabric of the whole that the divine reveals itself most fully, reveals itself. Divinity is within. And it is the perfection of the whole. So wholeness in traditional thinking is absolutely critical. And from that philosophy, you get some of the greatest architecture that we know today. This is Chartres, which was built at about the time of Aquinas. And what you see when you go into these wonderful cathedrals, this one is Lincoln, my favourite of all the English cathedrals, you see the same thing. What you're looking at, it seems to me, is the result of what I would describe as the crystalline analysis of nature. Because every single inch of these buildings conforms to the patterns that I've just been talking about, conforms very precisely to the patterns of development and growth and the geometry that, you know, obviously is much more complicated than I've described so far. But I think we've got cathedrals wrong as a result of this. Now, I've often wondered why it is they built them. Why did they take the care that they did to create these extraordinary and astonishing places that do have a power when you walk into them? I go to Lincoln quite regularly, and it's marvellous at Lincoln, because unless they need the chairs out, they don't put them out. So when you go in, particularly at 7 in the morning, when there's no one there at all, you see the cathedral as it should be seen, as it was intended to be seen. Unfortunately, the Victorians stuck a horrible organ in the middle of it, but we'll brush over that particular event. It's a beautiful organ, but it really does spoil the cathedral, in my view. What, for me, they were trying to create here was a concrete expression of the soul, a concrete expression of our relationship with the rest of the universe. Not a relationship where we are separate from, but we're participative in. So when you stand in one of these great buildings, you don't feel disconnected from it. You don't feel alien, as I always do when I walk into the Barbican. You feel very much as if you're part of it. And you resonate with it. I'm absolutely convinced of this harmonic response. And the symbolism is all over the place. So these wonderful rose windows, I think, are just another great example of what they were trying to demonstrate here. They're based upon the circle. The circle has two parts to it, the line and the point. You can't have a line without the point. And what I love about these circles is that these windows, rather, you know, wherever your eye goes in this vast great diversity, bounded by a unity, where does your eye keep getting drawn back to? It keeps being drawn back to the point of origin. So these are truly original works of art. They have a point of origin. They're talking about origin. Celtic crosses are rather interesting. We all know what Celtic crosses looked like. They predate Christianity. The Christian tradition elongated the stem so that it looked a bit more like a Christian cross. But actually, the important thing about Celtic crosses is not the cross, I don't think. It's the circle, with the point at the heart of it. And symbolically, what Celtic crosses were meant to demonstrate was this relationship between the feminine and the masculine. The masculine is the cross, and the feminine is the binding wholeness, the unity between heaven and earth. So very ancient symbols, which are just as apparent in Islamic art and architecture as well. So these are the wonderful pavements you find in places like Cordoba, based upon exactly the same patterns as the great cathedrals of the Western world. This is the cathedral in Cordoba, which of course originally was a mosque. Same patterning. And the whole shape of a mosque is profoundly symbolic. It demonstrates this relationship between the sphere and the cube, between the circle and the square. The square is, as I say, the symbol of earth, with its boundaries, and then the sphere is this unbounded unifying whole. So when you look at a typical mosque, what you're really looking at is that relationship between the circle and the square, the earthing of heaven, as someone put it to me. There is, as Satish was saying earlier, no duality, no separation. It is all one thing. The Prince of Wales founded the Prince's School of Traditional Arts to teach this. And whilst you take a break from me, I thought I'd just show you a little clip of a film I made about the school, mainly because it's, again, the prince explaining these things, just to underline how important they are, in his view, to him.
The whole issue of sacred geometry is of crucial importance to the work of my School of Traditional Arts, because as a result of years of painstaking study by people in the past, they began to understand the essential underlying principles beneath the surface on which the universe is based, and from that they drew so many lessons that enabled them to create the kind of architectures and craftsmanship which was so intimately reflective of those principles. The problem we all face nowadays, I think, is increasing disconnection from the natural world and from where we've come from and so on. So to use, you know, a compass and to build up from the circle, which is the foundation of everything, really, the symbol of unity.
So again, I'm taking the diagonal of the half square.
They suddenly can discover their connection with the natural world, because then the geometry that they learn, they realize, is linked to every flower, plant, tree, the way things grow, the way we grow and develop. They suddenly start to understand the fundamental connection with everything out there, instead of thinking they were completely separate from nature.
If you ever get the chance to go to the Prince's School of Traditional Arts, it's one of the most beautiful buildings in London, I think. It's like a great Aladdin's cave of beauty. They have this practice where every student, when they finish there and they graduate, they have to leave behind one piece of art. So over the years, they've collected this wonderful collection of pieces. And it has been something of a repository of almost lost knowledge. Again, I'd recommend, if you ever get the chance to see it, a film called Stairway to Heaven, which is a film about the restoration of the minbar in the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. It was firebombed in the 1960s. And the minbar is the Muslim pulpit. It's a staircase. And the mullah will, you know, declare from there. This minbar was built in the time of Saladin, and it was vast, and it was made up of hundreds and hundreds of different pieces of wood, thousands of them. Not one nail or piece of glue held this together. It was the geometry of the wood that held the whole thing together. And when it was firebombed, it was destroyed. And King Hussein of Jordan, who had responsibility for the mosque, sent out a worldwide plea for anybody who could work out how to rebuild it, because they'd lost the knowledge of how this geometry worked. And there were lots and lots of people who competed to try and come up with a solution. And they failed miserably. It went on for years, this. And then eventually there was a nomad from Saudi, I think he was, a nomadic family, rather. He was actually an engineer. And he was in Cairo one day, and he was in a bookshop in Cairo, and he picked a book up by Keith Critchlow and thought, ah, there's the answer. And the answer lay in the knowledge that was being kept alive by the Prince's School of Traditional Arts. And this engineer came to London. He did a year's study there, and eventually rebuilt the minbar according to this geometry. And it was only unveiled 3 or 4 years ago. And so you have this extraordinary fact that a Christian prince kept safe the knowledge which managed to restore one of the great emblems of the Islamic world. It's a traditional approach to arts and crafts, which is universal. And this is really why the prince was so concerned about it. So in the remaining time that I've got, I just want to quickly run through maybe why this is so relevant, because it's all well and good talking about all these wonderful things, but what's the relevance of all of this? Well, as you No doubt, no. And certainly the Prince of Wales has spent a lot of time pointing out. We are at a really terrifying moment in the history of the world, where we have slowly but surely engineered what could possibly become a perfect storm. What with population growth ballooning to 9 billion, with vast gaps between the rich and the poor developing, with food security being ever more threatened by the consequences of that, plus the amount of biodiversity that's being lost around the world. We're still burning rainforests at the rate of about a football field's worth of forest every 4 minutes. 26,000 football pitches a day. And, of course, all of these resources that we're using up. And then you've got the developing world developed in 2050. And this graph here just demonstrates that the possible threat that's on the horizon, if you like, in other words, the vast numbers of middle-class people that there will be in 2050 in what at the moment are still developing countries. So if you look at the year 2000, in China there were hardly any, but by 2050 there will be some 10% of the population will be middle-class. And all these other countries, India in particular, will have huge middle classes. The problem with the middle classes, us, is we tend to eat more meat, we tend to drive more cars, we tend to be much bigger consumers. So this graph actually is a rather terrifying graph when you think about it. And water in particular is going to become a big, big, big issue. So this graph here just demonstrates where the water stress will be. And as you can quite clearly see, the majority of it will be across a large swathe of some of the most populated parts of the world. So on the current projections, it is surmised that we'll need 50% more energy even by the year 2030. We may even need 50% more food than we're producing, and we have to produce all of that with 30% more water when there is less and less water around with which to produce what we already produce. I have some issues with some of those statistics because I think they belie all sorts of issues to do with waste. But certainly these are big problems. And so what are the solutions here? And what the Prince of Wales has tried to demonstrate is that there are possible solutions, but we have to move away from the culture that we've enjoyed for 150 years, which is a fossil fuel-based culture. We are and have enjoyed great wealth because of our dependence upon oil, which is, of course, running out. We do possibly have another 150 years of oil, maybe. It'll get expensive and more expensive to mine. And, of course, with the use of oil comes the big problem of CO2 emissions and global warming and climate change and so on and so forth. So are there technologies that move away from that? Are there ways of operating that move away from this linear form of economy that we've got, whereby we take from the earth, we consume it, and we waste, and then we have to deal with the waste? It's a linear form of economy. Well, there is technology around now, and I was in America very recently where they've just opened a huge new plant. In America, just to give you some statistics, they grow lots of wheat, obviously, and corn. Every year, as a consequence, they produce somewhere in the region, or leave behind when they've taken the harvest, somewhere in the region of a billion tons of organic waste. So this stuff left in the fields afterwards, a billion tons. That stuff is capable of producing somewhere in the region of 80 billion gallons of something called cellulosic ethanol. And a rather forward-thinking company called Dutch Royal DSM decided to do something about this, and they've just constructed a vast plant in Iowa. This is in Iowa, where they take all of this organic waste and they produce ethanol from it. It opened last year. It cost somewhere in the region of $250 million to build. And this is it. It doesn't look particularly attractive, I'm afraid. But in the first year, it's likely to produce somewhere in the region of 21 million gallons of ethanol. And once it's really up and running, it'll be producing 25 million tons of gallons, rather, of ethanol every year. This is a fuel that could replace oil-based fuels, with the great advantage that it doesn't produce nearly as much CO2. So if we're going to carry on with a car-based economy, which I fear we're going to do, it wouldn't be marvellous if we could do without them, but I don't think that's going to happen. Can we start looking at these sorts of technologies? Because what's so fascinating about this technology is that it isn't linear. It's circular. So the waste becomes the input for the new cycle. And this is really what the Prince of Wales has been trying to get across, that if we start thinking in terms of virtuous circles rather than vicious circles, which is what our economy tends to be based upon, then there may be solutions that we could find. And I found this particularly inspiring because, you know, it's all well and good talking in theory about these things, but here's something which could really make a quite dramatic difference to the way in which we operate. And in his own work, the Prince has done plenty of thinking about this and quite a bit of experimenting. One area which I'll just briefly touch upon is something called biomimicry, which I find fascinating. He's been an advocate of biomimicry for probably about 15, 20 years now, and he very recently helped to launch a company that was going to try and help the academics who've been developing this new science to get things to market, because there's a real reluctance amongst industry to invest in these ideas. Basically, in a nutshell, they put zoologists and biologists with engineers. The zoologists and the biologists can perhaps explain how nature works, and then the engineers can take that understanding and create new technologies out of it. And in the film that we made, we did a whole sequence on biomimicry using two people, one of whom is Janine Benyus, who was the person who invented the term. And we also found a rather remarkable Australian engineer who's developing all sorts of wonderful technologies. So I thought I'd just show you a little clip of this film. The Prince is the narrator of it.
We try to bring nature's inspiration to the sustainable design of everything, from cars to how we grow crops to how we heat our homes to how we build our cities.
There's no such thing as an energy crisis in nature. Never has been, never will be. Nature has solved all of these problems.
The spider, for instance, is a model for a fiber that is 5 times stronger, ounce for ounce, than steel. It's kind of a miracle material.
If we copy nature, we can create better machines, we can create better opportunities, we can extract more resources without being destructive. I'm Jay Harmon, chief inventor and CEO of PAX Scientific, that specialize in studying how nature manages to design incredibly energy-efficient systems. The way we pump things and fans and air conditioners and wind turbines and hydro turbines, the blueprints there, nature's already proven it to us. It's pretty simple. Now, what is a fan but basically a collection of wings? Well, who makes the best wings in the world? Nature does.
These swallows are more maneuverable than any aircraft that we have right now. I mean, aeronautics engineers are jealous of these guys. One of the things that they're looking at swallows and swifts for is the interesting way that as they're flying to make an adjustment, they'll move their wings back, and this streamlines them.
Janine Benyus came up with the term biomimicry, the idea that solutions can be found by looking at nature and copying the way she works.
They're actually looking at morphing aircraft that would be able to move their wings back and use less fossil fuel as a result.
One of the misunderstandings with bird flight is that we think it's flapping up and down, but they're actually rotating. They have a rotating moment to them. They create whirlpools of air off the end of the wings. This is the archetypal shape of movement in our universe. The same principles as a tornado and a hurricane. There is something mysterious and magical that in all of this chaotic world that we live in, there is this beautiful pattern It shows up everywhere and it underlies all life. It's like the thumbprint of God, if you like. And it's beautiful, and it's functional.
Nature may appear chaotic, but there are shapes and movements that are common throughout the natural world. If we can escape our conventional view, it can transform the way in which we look at the world and make us see that we are part of this ordered harmony. What other discoveries can we make if we turn our attention to these universal patterns of nature? What solutions could this understanding offer, in particular to the growing energy crisis?
We've now created the first new refrigeration cycle in 100 years, built exactly according to Nietzsche's wings. It runs on water, it doesn't need esoteric gases that destroy the ozone, and it uses 90% less energy than current air conditioning systems. 90% less energy. So this is nature at its best. If you think that air conditioners currently use nearly 30% of all the world's electricity, if we can reduce that 30% by 90%, that's a very big deal. Big deal in terms of energy supply and a big deal in terms of reducing global warming gases.
Life's been around for 3.8 billion years, and in that time has learned to harvest solar energy and circumnavigate the world and fly without fossil fuels and live at the top of a mountain, bottom of the sea, things that we can only dream about doing, life has learned how to do, and has learned how to do it sustainably. You know, once a species is gone, it's not just the materials of its body that are gone, it's the wisdom, it's the knowledge that it has for us. It's very different to move from just learning about the natural world so that you might exploit it, to learning from the natural world. That switch from learning about to learning from is what biomimicry is about.
We've got a world economy in crisis. We need a new economy, we need a new paradigm. That paradigm is biomimicry. We can reinvent this world. For humans, it's a lack of imagination. We're not looking at nature. There's our library, there's our mentor, there's our inspiration.
It's a very interesting subject. So that's biomimicry. I just want to touch on one other subject before I finish. And I thought I'd just try and challenge one particular myth about the Prince of Wales, which is to do with architecture. Because obviously he's well known for his concerns about architecture. Actually, in my experience, he's more concerned about urban planning and the way in which we build the places in which we live. This is an aerial shot of a traditional village. I think it's in Malawi. I just find it interesting, don't you, that at the very centre of the village there is a circle. I've never done this with this photograph, but I wouldn't be surprised if you could get a spiral out of that somehow. There's something about that pattern that demonstrates the spiral. This rather rough drawing is a drawing I stole from the Prince's Foundation for Building Community. What you're looking at here is a rough sketch of how traditional towns develop. They tend to start on a crossroads, and then they expand to a certain distance, 180... I can't read that, sorry, I've got my glasses. I can't read it. It's about 300 yards, I think. And then slowly but surely, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. And at a certain point, people get a bit tired of walking back into the centre of town. So they tend to start another town. And so you end up with this sort of honeycomb effect. So if you were to fly over, I don't know, one of the sort of traditional towns or cities in Italy, this is the pattern you'd see. If you were to fly over North London, this is the sort of pattern you could possibly trace. I would wager you don't see this if you fly over Milton Keynes. You certainly don't see it if you fly over most American cities. I flew into LA recently. One of the most depressing and frightening images I think I've ever seen. This, from horizon to horizon, this, you know, matrix, which I find immediately depressing. I don't know, it's just something I can't bear. I lived in Derbyshire for a while, in Derby, and they built the biggest housing estate in Europe at the time. I forget how many thousands of houses there were. There wasn't one school or shop in it. but it was vast. And you had to have a car to get to the supermarket because the supermarket sat on the other side of a double, you know, dual carriageway. This is the way that it's going around the world. This is a rather complex diagram to show you, but don't worry about the detail. I just thought I'd throw it up here, because if you look at the top half of it, what you're looking at there is what, apologies if anyone's from Essex here, but what's generally known as the Essex Plan. It's a way of town building, which became the norm, really, across certainly Britain, from the 1950s onwards. So in other words, everything's zoned, everything's separated out. So in the middle of the picture, you've got the housing estate. To the left, you've got a business park. To the right, you've got schools. And then eventually, miles away, you've got the shopping centre. And this is what it's like in America. I was staying with a friend in LA, and we went to a liquor stall to get some liquor, where you couldn't buy anything else but liquor, and then you had to get in a car and drive another 10 miles to go and buy your groceries. You know, it's all car-based. This is the Essex Plan, zoning. The second half of the diagram, the lower half, is a much more integrated approach to urban planning. I suspect this is what you'd see if you flew over Paris, where you have mixed use buildings, commercial, domestic. Everything's much more integrated. It's much more walkable. You don't have to walk far to get everything that you want. The only reason I show you this diagram is because I think there's a big myth about the prince's ambition with Poundbury in Dorset, which comes in for a great deal of stick because it looks very pretty and rather faux Georgian architecture. But underpinning that experiment is this patterning that I've been talking about, a much more integrated approach. And look at the land use. Look at the land use. We're running out of land. The Essex Plan, which is the predominant way of town planning, uses a lot more space than the sort of town planning that the Prince of Wales has been advocating, which is why he created this first experiment in this approach at Poundbury. Poundbury is an extension to Dorchester. Dorchester had to expand, and this was part of the local plan, and the local authority basically compulsorily insisted on there being an extension. It happened to extend into the Duchy of Cornwall's land. And the prince insisted on this occasion that he was not going to see another Essex Plan housing estate. He wanted to try something else, and this is what he created. And what fascinates me about this whole approach is, well, two things, really. Firstly, the desire to try and create somewhere that gives you a sense of place. So although it gets a lot of stick for the kind of, you know, rather beautiful architecture, this is the architecture that you find in that part of Dorsetshire. And more important than that is the patterning that you get. So a lot of the architecture is based upon the classical proportions. It is pleasing to us. I certainly find this a far more pleasing architecture to look at. It doesn't all look the same. Lots of different diversity within its unity. And there are no roads, really, in Poundbury. The buildings make the space. It's a much more walkable place. There are roads, but as you can see, they don't last long before they change their width. The car isn't dominant. Every 500 yards or so, there's what they would call an event. In this case, that building juts out. And I've certainly driven round here, and it's quite odd. There are no road signs, but you don't want to drive quickly. And touch wood, so far, there's been no road accidents at all in Poundbury. The car isn't dominant. Every house has a garage. You can have a car. But the idea is this principle of the spiral, the walkable town. So it's a series of little villages. And as I say, the architecture is panned by the architectural brigade because it looks a little bit chocolate boxy. But since Poundbury, there have been lots of other developments. In Swansea, there's a huge new one on a restored oil refinery, Coed Darcy it's called. If you go up to Scotland, they're developing one outside Cumnock. There's a place called Upton on the outskirts of Northampton. And in the city of London now, this actually is Islington, Highbury Gardens, they've just developed this low-rise development The street is very, very significant. It's right in the heart of Islington, this. I don't know if you're aware of the row over Mount Pleasant Post Office, in the sorting office in London, where there was this great debate over what they were going to do with the old site. And there's been a huge debate about creating low-rise versus high-rise. And dear old Boris bottled out and decided against the lower rise development, which to my eye looked rather like this. Curiously, there were more flats in the low rise than in the high rise development. But instead, as it stands, Mount Pleasant is going to look like something out of Stalinist Russia. But there we are. That's developers for you. So it's not just Poundbury. They don't all look the same. The idea is to give you a sense of place and a feeling for the architecture, the vernacular architecture of the area, and to base it upon these principles of harmony, the interdependency of the natural system. There's no zoning involved. And just finally, the Prince has also created this little house, which sits in Watford at the Building Research Centre, and it's called the Natural House. He wanted to demonstrate to bulk builders that you can build much more sustainable kinds of houses on a vast scale. So this house is built of an interesting German brick, which is empty in the middle, and he's just got this extraordinary capacity to breathe in the winter, in the summertime, but he's also incredibly insulative in the winter. So you reduce the amount of... This is a zero carbon emission house. It's got wool insulation. Wool is an extraordinary material. You try burning it. It's pretty difficult to burn, for example. It obviously keeps a sheep nice and dry in the winter, even though it's wet. And then, of course, it also breathes in the summer as well. So this house has been built. People have been living in it. So they've done all sorts of research into their views of it. It went to the Ideal Home exhibition as well, in an attempt to try and get some traction on the building industry to start looking at these different ways of building. And he's done a lot of work on drainage and other boring things that he delights in talking about. If you go to Upton in Northamptonshire, they've developed this drainage system which follows the way in which nature would drain. The problem with drainage in modern urban settings is it's all centralised. So everything flows into one great big pipe and gets rushed away. So if you have a flash flood, it overwhelms. And it floods, whereas nature creates lots of different channels. So in Upton in Northamptonshire, you could walk around and there are these lovely swathes of green, lovely for biodiversity. But when the rain comes and the storms come, it takes the water away, stores it, in fact, and removes it gradually. And of course, the building industry would argue that this is far too expensive to build because it costs more money. And again, the Prince of Wales has been trying to demonstrate that, of course, if you take the short-term view, yes, of course it does. If you take the long-term view, in terms of the number of insurance claims that people would no doubt put in because of flooding and all of the psychological and deep hurt that people suffer when they suffer flooding, well, you know, what are the costs that you're talking about? Should we not be taking a much more long-term view? All I think he can really try and do is ask these questions, and I think he's certainly not got the answers. He wouldn't argue he's got the answers. He's just asking questions. Is there another way of doing this? And given that nature has found so many solutions, should we not look more closely at the way in which nature operates? So just to go back to Eve Balfour's phrase again, you can see, I think, why it's such an important observation. We are too obsessed with the causes of disease. Disease, the word itself is fascinating, isn't it? The unbalancing of the equilibrium. But if you concentrate on the causes of health and you work back from there, you do find you have this awareness that you have to think in a different kind of way. You have to be holistic. I was in America just 2 weeks ago and had a wonderful afternoon with a man I've long admired and known, Wendell Berry, who said to me, I don't like the word holistic. It's used by people who aren't confident enough to say holy. Which I thought was rather wonderful. That last phrase, though, this led inevitably to an awareness of wholeness and to a gradual understanding that all life is one. If you look at the emerald tablet written by the ancient Egyptians 4,000 years ago, you'll find that very same phrase, all life is one. Thank you very much.
Ian, for a very comprehensive account and so beautifully put together. I wish I could produce a PowerPoint like that. I love the car park going up in smoke. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes for any reflections or questions you might have. There's one thing that would sort of add to what you've said, Ian, and that's that I've always liked the phrase of Victor Schauberger, when he said, what we should do so far as nature is concerned is kapieren und kopieren. So kapieren is to understand, and kopieren, obviously, to copy. So understand nature and copy, which is very sort of statement of biomimicry.
Yes, yes.
Sarah?
Yeah, all I wanted to say was that the Prince's School of Traditional Arts does week-long summer courses, so you don't have to do the whole year. And I did one on sacred geometry last year, and it is certainly something that other people might be interested in.
Yes,
Luke Sala, I just finished a book on the connected city, and one of the problems is innovation. How do you get innovation? And there are like two major schools. And the one is the venture capital model of Silicon Valley, and the other one is the British amateur.
The British amateur?
Yes, yeah. it's an innovation model. And I think the Prince of Wales is the classic British amateur, you know, he has yes. time in his hands. And we're talking about really, in the history of science, the British amateur was for a long time the leading model.
Yes.
Yes. And then the Americans came in and they forced everything with atomic bombs and venture capital. But
I think it's interesting you say that. Although I think he would probably argue that it was one of his German ancestors who was the great. British amateur in Prince Albert. I think there is a lot of similarity in their approaches. If you look at what he did for the Royal Albert Hall and its precincts, same sort of wish to improve. Yes, yes. He doesn't claim to be an expert. Then the freedom to improve. Yes, yes, indeed, yes.
Thank you very, very much, Ian, for a very inspiring talk. If we recall that Elizabeth I translated Berthius, and as did Chaucer, of course, would you say that the book Harmony is now another example of what David described as the priest-king-philosopher, the very necessary philosophical and prophetic component just to the function of royalty?
Well, it's a very difficult subject for the prince to talk about, and I have once or twice between you and me ventured to ask him that sort of question, and he gets terribly uncomfortable about talking about it. But I think underneath it all lies this sense that he obviously has a duty, and he would contend that he has a calling. He is a deeply spiritual man, in my experience, and I think a long time ago he decided that given this bizarre situation that he finds himself in, this complete accident of birth, coupled with what I would argue are innate feelings. I don't think anyone's given him these ideas. He felt obliged to do something about it and to act on it and to study it and then to try and put good into the world, which I think is all he's really trying to do. He feels very, restricted, obviously, in many respects. I mean, he's done a lot of work as a farmer and as a gardener, and obviously with his attempts with town planning and so on and so forth. But what he's realized is his ability to convene people, to bring people together, often of differing views. For example, I was in Louisville in Kentucky 2 weeks ago when he was there. Louisville has a real problem with air quality. It's terrible. And it also has the dirtiest river in America. And he was able to bring together the heads of health insurance companies whose costs are going through the roof because so many people are ill because of this problem, and the CEOs of heavy industry to demonstrate to them, they'd never spoken before, that actually they're both stakeholders in improving the health of people, because there's a very strong connection between poor air quality and cardiovascular disease, and it's very high in that part of the world. And so bringing people together, often who have never spoken to each other or see themselves as adversaries, and convening those people and getting them to work together, he realizes is another part of the process. I think privately he probably does feel that is his duty. He feels called to do it, and he would be denying himself, I think, if he sat on his hands. And therein lies the big problem for the future, of course.
Thank you. And my question is, do you know from what age he started in this path of both spirituality and being aware of the environment, and what triggered him to do it? Because on the one hand, you expected like somebody to supposed to be like a spoil, you know, next prince, to be quite spoiled. So what's triggered him to go to this spiritual and environment concern?
I think there are a couple of things in his life that maybe mattered early on. Although he's talked about Gordonston as being the school that he went to as being Colditz with kilts, I think he got a lot out of that school, really. I don't know what you think of that, David, but it taught him a lot about self-reliance. It taught him about discipline. It taught him about self-discipline in particular, and he's an incredibly self-disciplined person. I mean, he will not change his routine for anybody. So no matter how many receptions he might have done in a day, and it could be three or four, where he works a room of 300 people and moves on to another one, and you try doing that 5 days of the week, he will still be at his desk at midnight. And when the clock goes bong at midnight, that's when he goes to bed, and he's back up again and on the day again. So, and that's a 7 day week thing quite often. It's not a 5 day week. So he's incredibly self-disciplined. So I think his schooling had something to do with that. Maybe he would disagree with me here, but maybe his father's influence is quite strong as well. But the other big thing was just what was happening in the 60s. He's said, I think he's on record as saying that he was appalled by the way in which hedgerows being ripped out, farms were being, you know, destroyed and made bigger, and the way in which it was agriculture, I think, which kick-started so many things in him. What we were doing to the soil, and this whole process of forgetting the soil and instead farming chemically. Because at its most extreme, we don't farm using soil. We farm because of, you know, using chemicals. And I think that was really the big start. And then, of course, you had the same thing happening in urban planning as well, this forgetting of the human scale of things.
Thank you. Charles. Ian, that was extremely interesting and sympathetic portrayal of the prince. And
go on.
I agree. Yeah.
I agree with 95% of what you said. I wrote a book in 1987 on the prince called The Prince. I spoke to you about this, yes. The Prince, The Architects, and New Wave Monarchy. And I made the argument that he was trying to open a space of creativity for his children and himself, as instead of being like the Japanese monarchy, under kind of house arrest. And I think his creativity is very strong. And I applaud 90% of what he does. But in doing the research for this book, and I published all his speeches then on architecture, I mentioned to you over lunch that I found Anthony Sampson, who's a friend, interviewed him when he just came out of Cambridge. And he said, made this incredibly strange remark, which is in the Anatomy of Britain, first edition, said, well, of course, The monarchy is an elective system. If they don't want us, they'll get rid of us. He was trained at Cambridge, and he was obviously studying medieval history and anthropology and so on, and I think he really took on a historical view. I mean, if you think of Scottish kings and elections and kings in Europe, Barcelona and so on, the kings had to be between the people and the nobles sometime, and I think the prince was very affected by his being at Cambridge and saw that his role was like an extra official ombudsman to speak directly to the people over the heads of the bureaucrats, over the head of the modernists, over the head of the power structure and the establishment. And so, you know, in a way, he was trying to invent, and to a certain extent has, cut his own space, you know, and more power to him, and in a literal sense. Of course, there are problems here. Let me just, I talked with Keith Critchlow, who I admire and like and love his theories too, but now we'll come to some difficulties. One is that Le Corbusier's words and his early work, and even Erno Goldfinger, whose buildings you hate, as indeed I dislike, based it on the golden section, Fibonacci, and all of those proportional systems, and did regulating lines, you know, ad nauseum. Now, the problem here is that clients don't want to pay for it, and the rest of society today, particularly in a mercantile culture, doesn't want to pay. Another problem, and I've done this myself, is you can put your protractors in your drawings, and you can pull out of any... There's redundancy in all these geometries, and if you have one geometrical system, as any mathematician, geometrician would tell you, there will be several embedded other things. And so the problem has been you can prove a lot by drawing over architecture. I've done it all of my life, and I know how you can prove what you want to prove. So the first problem is that modernist architects thought they were doing holism in the prince's sense, and in Le Corbusier's sense was a lot of the time, but society wouldn't go along with them. So, I mean, so to come to the question, you know, modernism gets blamed, but and the prince really went on the attack, and Why did he attack it so strongly rather than trying to persuade it? Because remember when he came out in 19...
Well, I think it was so extreme at the time, and I think he felt that somebody needed to raise the voice of the ordinary people, because there was this intellectual attitude amongst a certain group of people who were making these decisions and affecting people's lives. As he said himself many times, you know, he wouldn't dream of walking into your house and criticizing the paintings on your walls. That's your personal taste. But architecture is in the public realm and it affects people's lives. I was in Nottingham 2 or 3 years ago where they just built a big new art gallery, and everyone was tremendously excited by this new art gallery they were putting up and couldn't wait for all of the, you know, the hoardings to be taken down, which were pretty ugly and unsightly. And I was in the city the day that they suddenly realized this was the building. And I was in the BBC and they had a phone-in on the local radio station with people really upset that this eyesore, in their view, was being planted in the middle of their city. And we're making the sorts of comments that, you know, the Prince of Wales was making 20 or 30 years ago, but suddenly realizing what he'd been going on about. You know, what right do you have to affect my sense of belonging? It was one phrase that I heard said at the time. So I think, I take your point. I mean, you know, what did he achieve by saying what he said? In my view, Paternoster Square is a much more elegant place to be these days next to St. Paul's than it would have been, my personal view. And I think he affected ordinary people to think about their urban spaces. So I don't think he was going to ever persuade the architects, was he? They were too... And in fact, it's very interesting. 2 months ago, the Architectural Review is it called the Architectural Review? One of the most widely circulated magazines in the architecture industry, launched what they called a big rethink, which basically they said, did we get a lot of this wrong? And as a leader article, guess who they asked to submit 2,000 words to just explain what he was really all about. He couldn't believe it when the request came through, and he did ponder it a long time, because it is a lion's den, you know, when you walk into that particular world. But it was very interesting, I thought, that and if you talk to architects of today, I think they have been affected by it, and there's a much more positive view of these ideas around. Architects aren't quite as extreme as they were. I work in classical music. I mean, I've spent 20 years on Radio 3, sometimes having to endure things that I just cannot stand listening to. I'm so sorry about this, but, you know, if only I could say sometimes, wasn't that awful? And the point is that, you know, I don't, obviously. But it's interesting to me that music went in a similar kind of way. And music that I personally find I can't listen to and find anything in it that I can remember. I never want to go back to it and listen to it again. It almost seems like a sort of orchestral exercises. It's very interesting to play quite often. If you talk to the BBC Symphony Orchestra, they love playing all this new contemporary stuff. But I just worry about... It's the same... It certainly was the same thing in music in the 60s, with composers who were willing to put in harmony and melody actively banned from the BBC.
Well, Ian, I don't think we're going to say, wasn't that awful? To you,
I don't mind.
I think what you've been able to convey is the sort of the depth of vision and thought that is expressed in the Prince's philosophy and indeed in the various manifestations of it. And this is something that I tried to do as well by showing that there was a coherence between his views on science, agriculture, and health. And then showing how these, in turn, were related to the sense of the sacred, the geometry, the proportion, the harmony, and so I think the message is actually incredibly important, which is one of the reasons why we put this conference on, because we felt that to have an opportunity to talk about harmony, the nature of harmony, the application of harmony in these various different ways would be a valuable exercise, and I think today has shown exactly that. Before I ask people to join in thanking you, I just got one other image for music, because I remember I was at a debating society in Edinburgh. This is a 250-year-old essay and debating society called the Speculative Society, which the Duke of Edinburgh is actually a member. And I remember one piece of music was described as a prolonged motorway pile-up. I just thought that was very. It was a very good image.
Yes, I probably sat through it.
Sort of describe the sort of the grating sensation that you had. I think you've you put this. If I could put together a PowerPoint like that, I'd be so proud. I don't have the sort of technical ability, but you've conveyed the Prince's philosophy and applications very eloquently. And I'm sure he'd be. I'm sure he would have been delighted if he'd been here. So thank you very much indeed. Yeah.